You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news in technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Folks, when's the last time you checked your credit scores? Because your scores may change more often than you think, and you should know what they are now and not from a year ago. You know what they say, information is power, and Credit Karma is here to help out. The best thing? Credit Karma is always free and there's no catch. No credit card needed. Go to creditkarma.com or download the Credit Karma app now. Again, that's creditkarma.com or download the app. And now, enjoy the podcast.
The Doomsday Machine is designed to trigger itself automatically.
But surely you can disarm it somehow?
No, it is designed to explode if any attempt is ever made to untrigger it.
But how is it possible for this thing to be triggered automatically and at the same time impossible to untrigger?
Mr. President, it is not only possible, it is essential. That is the whole idea of this machine, you know. Deterrence is the art of producing in the mind of the enemy the fear to attack. And so, because of the automated and irrevocable decision-making process which rules out human meddling, the Doomsday Machine is terrifying. It's simple to understand and completely credible and convincing.
Gee, I wish we had one of them Doomsday Machines, Stacy.
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was a scene from Stanley Kubrick's classic film Doctor Strangelove. The plot involves a rogue bomber and a terrifying doomsday machine that consists of a system of bombs designed to destroy the world upon the detection of a single nuclear explosion. At the time, the very idea of such a device made for biting political satire, but my guest today says exactly such a plan existed and may still exist today. He knows because he helped design America's nuclear war strategy, and he's since dedicated his life to dismantling that very system that threatens to annihilate the world. The legendary whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg is famous for exposing America's classified plan for the Vietnam War in the Pentagon Papers, and in a new book titled The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, he reveals that he still has some secrets to share. Secrets that should send chills down the spines of every man, woman, and child alive. And today he discloses that the president isn't the only one with his finger on the nuclear button and explains just how far down the chain of command that authority may reverberate. He reveals the potentially staggering human cost of America's first strike strategy, the perverse logic behind the Joint Chiefs' apparent peace with that risk, and their calculated willingness to obliterate U.S. allies in the process. Plus, he weighs in on the nuclear game of chicken between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. He lends some credence to the idea that there's a so-called deep state operating beyond the president's authority. And America's most famous whistleblower shatters the myth that all secrets in Washington eventually get leaked. Coming up with Daniel Ellsberg in just a moment. Today I'm talking with Daniel Ellsberg, the legendary whistleblower who released the classified Pentagon Papers, which exposed the true scale and, in some cases, criminality of the Vietnam War. But the Pentagon Papers, as it turns out, weren't the only secrets he's been holding on to. He writes about it in a new book called The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Daniel Ellsberg, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, you're best known for the Pentagon Papers, and you say that you originally planned to follow up the Pentagon Papers with an expose of America's top secret nuclear war strategy. So why did it take you over 45 years to finally write this book?
Well, first of all, the realities then and now are so horrific and apparently insane when first encountered and when second encountered and later, that it's really hard to get people to believe them unless you have documents. I intended to have documents, but I separated the nuclear documents that I took from my top secret safe at the Rand Corporation from the Vietnam War documents, the history of Vietnam decision-making that came to be known as the Pentagon Papers. I thought that the nuclear material was really more important to the world, but that a lot of it was many years old already then, and the bombs were actually falling in Vietnam right at that time. So I hoped to have some effect on shortening the war in Vietnam first, and I put the nuclear papers separately in charge of my brother, as a matter of fact, in New York. He put them through a series of steps, ultimately buried in a trash dump in New York, where a tropical storm, Doria, hit that area and dispersed all the materials. And for a year and a half, he tried to recover them. But by the time my trial ended in 1975, we had to acknowledge that they were beyond reach.
I see. So that's why you didn't write about this immediately after the Pentagon Papers dropped.
I did. I was prepared to tell the substance of those stories really right away, as soon as the war ended in 75. My trial, I said, ended in 75. It ended in 73. The war went on for a couple more years. And when it ended in 75, I intended to put out the substance of that material without the documents. But the publishers that I approached said, no, no one is interested in that subject. We couldn't sell more than 1,400 copies, said one editor. And I thought, well, that's one for every member of Congress. That's okay with me. She said, no, that means we wouldn't publish them. And for the next 40 years, really, I spent a lot of time trying to help build a movement like the anti-war movement that might be against nuclear weapons. There was some promise at some point with the bilateral nuclear weapons freeze movement 20 years later. But that fell apart for a number of reasons, but especially when the Cold War ended and people thought the problem had gone away. It hadn't. The weapons are still there, fewer of them, but still on hair trigger alert, and enough of them to cause nuclear winter, we now know, that would cause near extinction of humanity. So the problem is still with us. It didn't start with Donald Trump, and it's not going to end with Donald Trump.
And the title of the book is a reference to the Doomsday Machine from Stanley Kubrick's famous movie Dr. Strangelove. Now, most of us probably see Dr. Strangelove as farce or satire, but what did you think when you first walked out of that film?
When I saw that film, as a matter of business, really, I was working in the Pentagon on war plans at the time and went with my boss, later president of RAND, Harry Rowan. We went during a working day to see a movie, the only time I can remember ever doing that, going over to D.C. from Arlington, from the Pentagon. And we came out of that movie saying that was a documentary.
Wow.
Everything in that movie could have happened, really, not just hypothetically, but the possibilities were really there. The people who had put that together clearly had benefited by a lot of inside information. In fact, I later found that the major author of that had been an RAF British pilot in Bomber Command, and he actually it was evident that some of the great dangers of the Strategic Air Command planning, SAC planning that I was aware of, were also in the RAF, and he had reproduced them.
So there were real-world scenarios in that film that you recognized from your work at RAND Corp. Can you give us an example?
Such as the fact that there was no stop order, that once an authorized order had gone out to the bombers to be bombers, it took them hours to get to the Soviet Union, there was no authentic authorized way to call them back. That's a feature in the film, very implausible,
yeah.
After all. Who could believe that? But as they say in the film, by the way, I think the president says, well, you know, how could this be? How could you arrange this? They said, well, we were afraid if we had a code to call them back, the Russians might get it and they would call our forces back. And that was pretty much the reason that SAC gave for not having a stop order. And as I say, when we came out, I thought, how could they know that? It was a very esoteric secret that we had this vulnerability in our system. That if the Russians surrendered, for example, in the hours during which most of our bombers were approaching, or if the president wanted to change the plan or do something different, he couldn't. And by the way, I was told by colonels in the air staff that was really the reason there was no stop order. They worried that our civilian commander-in-chief would have second thoughts, would chicken out, could not be depended on to carry this thing through. So once they'd gotten an order out of him, there would be no turning back.
Another idea that many of us probably get from movies as well is this image of the president opening the nuclear football and entering the launch codes. And I think that's led to an assumption that only the president can authorize a nuclear war. But you say in the book that's not really the case, right?
That's surprising to many people, shocking when they first hear it. And yet, logically, if they think about it, there's a case where you couldn't allow the Soviets or a terrorist or anybody else to paralyze our response simply by killing the president or even by putting a bomb on Washington. So going back to Eisenhower, and ever since, there has been delegation to a number. How many? Hard to say. Probably the president never really knows, no given president, just how many people could give that order if they chose. But it certainly is more people who have their, quote, finger on the button, metaphorically, than the president, and more than just the Joint Chiefs of Staff or the Secretary of Defense. That was in the movie, and that was documentary, too, and still is.
Once you learned this, you started to talk to people down the chain of command to see who else thought that they had that kind of authority. And you had a rather chilling conversation with the commander at a base at Kunsan, Korea. What was his understanding of the protocol for a nuclear launch?
That is one that I remember very vividly. When I discovered that Eisenhower had delegated to field commanders, four-star generals like Sink Pak, Commander-in-Chief Pacific, Harry D. Felt, for whom I was doing a research project at that time. And I heard that he had authority, and then I learned that he had sub-delegated that to lower commanders, not only to 7th Fleet, but below that. I wanted to find out just how this thing worked at the far end, the trigger point. So I picked a base, Kunsan, Korea, which I think was then the most northern base in Korea. I don't know if that's still true for our forces. And went out there. It was sort of a little western town almost, just an airstrip with some Quonset huts surrounded by mountains. And asked the major there, and I won't go through the whole thing. It was an interesting dialogue in a way. What if you thought that your base was about to be attacked? If there was indications of a war going on perhaps elsewhere, or an accident elsewhere, that a nuclear explosion even, that indicated that an attack might be happening, what would you do? And he said, well, you know what we're supposed to do. We send the planes. I would send the planes off their strip, their alert strip. And he had 10 F-100s on an alert strip, each with a 1.1 megaton, that's million tons equivalent of TNT, bomb under this one plane with one person on it. And that's half the tonnage of high explosive that we dropped in World War II. We dropped 2 million tons. So half a World War II was under each of these 10 planes run by this major. Well, what he was saying, that he would send them off to a rendezvous area where they would circle around until they got a positive order. It was called positive control system, a positive order to go ahead, but get them off the ground to keep them from being destroyed. He knew, and I knew, that was against his orders. For various reasons I won't go into here, he was not supposed to protect his planes by taking them off the ground. It was too dangerous. They might explode on accident. But as he said, it's the oldest principle of war that a commander can protect his own forces. So he felt he was authorized to do that. So I said, okay, they go up for the first time now. They had never run a rehearsal of this. first time that he's gotten the planes off and they're up there, they're out of communication with him, what do they do? What will they do? He said, well, you know what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to wait around until they get low on fuel, and then with no positive order, they're to come back. And I said, what do you think they would do? And he said, oh, I think they'd come back, most of them.
Most of them.
And when he said, think, you know, I was already thinking, you think they'd come back? He's the commander of them. He trains them. You know, he's in charge of them. So you think he'd come back? And I'm like, that was reverberating in my head when I heard him go on to say, most of them, in a calm way. And then he said, of course, if one of them did break out and go for target, the others might as well too, you know, because the war would be on. So that actually, that's pretty close to the situation in Dr. Strangelove too, as you recognize, if you've seen a rerun of that recently. And that referred to the Strategic Air Command. It's not unlike that ever since.
Really? You don't think they've made some improvements by now?
Yes, there are more controls. There are more controls. For example, they put locks, and finally, on Minuteman ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles that are buried in three states, still 400 of them. And they put locks that so they couldn't run, they couldn't be launched without an order from higher headquarters. But by order of the Air Force, all the locks were set at 0000000080. In short, the Air Force didn't want anything possibly mixing up people, getting the wrong signal, getting one, and not getting the bomb off when it was wanted. And a final point, those ICBMs are nothing other than lightning rods for attack. There's no circumstances under which it would be to our benefit to launch those, whether we'd been attacked or not been attacked. And wow. That's true for the Russian ICBMs as well. So there's a madness to the continuation of these systems, which have the power to cause, and we haven't talked about this yet, but cause nuclear winter, which would lead to near extinction of humanity.
The reality of this is almost more absurd than the actual movie.
Yes.
And as part of your work at RAND and as an assistant to Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, you actually helped draft the military's top secret plan for a general nuclear war. What was that plan?
Well, it was probably the most insane and immoral plan, in both, in the history of warfare, in the history of humanity. It called essentially for trucking by air, every warhead on missiles or planes or submarines that we had in our arsenal. No reserves. Quite unusual war plan with no provision for reserves, whatever. Throwing everything at the first opportunity against a wide target plan, target system in the Soviet Union and China at that time, even though by 1960 and 61, the Chinese and Soviet bloc had dissolved. They were moving to be increasingly suspicious of each other and non-cooperative. But that wasn't reflected in our plans at all. If there was any war, conflict with the Soviet Union, the plan was not to leave China sitting by, you know, to reap the rewards of the two superpowers having destroyed each other. No, China would also be destroyed, even if they'd had nothing to do with the initiation of the war. So the plan called for hitting every city in Russia and China, over 25,000 people. They were conscious that it would end in the killing by our initiation in the USSR and China, Communist China, 325 million dead within 6 months. 275 million immediately from blast radiation, prompt radiation, and heat. And then with fallout month by month over the next 6 months, another 50 million. So a total of 325 million people. Another 100 million in East Europe, what we called the captive countries. We were going to annihilate them, 100 million, because they had air defenses in their position. They had command, control, transit, and so forth. Another 100 million in Western Europe, our allies, not by any of our warheads falling on their territory, and not yet by any Russian warheads, but by the radioactive fallout from our own strikes in East Europe and Russia. So we're prepared to sacrifice, in effect, 100 million of our allies to our first strike, whatever the purpose of that strike was, let's say to regain primacy, to reduce damage in the United States, which it would not do, but, you know, to try to do that. A third 100 million would come from areas contiguous to the Soviet Union, mostly neutrals, like Austria, Finland, and areas like Japan and India. Another 300 million, in other words, for a total of 600 million, which I looked at as 100 holocausts. And that's without Russian retaliation on Europe or anything else. That would bring it up over a billion. That was a third of the Earth's population at that time, and that's what they were planning to achieve. Now, that's an insanity that really, you know, it explodes any human language. What can you call it? A crime, a sin, a stupidity? Wait a minute. We're talking about deliberately, having prepared it for years and practiced it and rehearsed it, exterminating a third of the Earth's population.
And when you ask the Joint Chiefs how many lives would be lost in a nuclear war with Russia, they came back with that estimate in no time, which would lead one to the conclusion that they had already weighed the risks and considered those casualties an acceptable or at least necessary cost of war.
In my mistaken belief that they hadn't calculated this, that the vast destruction they were going to wreak had not been calculated by them adequately, I was wrong about that. The Joint Staff, working for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they did know it. The Joint Chiefs, without any apology, without any resignation or sign of anguish or anything else, they came right back with an answer. There was no accountability for that. They all continued in their jobs, continued doing it, in the expectation that they would not be fired as a result of having constructed this plan. And they were right. They weren't.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Daniel Ellsberg when we come back in just a minute. The Art of Charm is an iTunes Top 50 podcast that's packed with wisdom in the truest sense of the word. From how to become more productive and professional to how to read body language, network, and negotiate, the show basically covers anything that will help you become a high performer at home and at work. And with a powerful armory of weapons like influence and persuasion, it brings together interesting people like Shaq, Russell Brand, Larry King, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and Bill Nye to discuss relationships, attraction, life hacking, and success. The Art of Charm is highly addictive and strives to be fun and educational at the same time. It's not stuffy college professor textbook stuff. Personal growth shouldn't be so boring all the time. This isn't pop psychology and superficial advice. This is a show that offers meaningful, fun, life-changing insights with a practical edge that you can apply right out of the box. You deserve an extraordinary life, so go to theartofcharm.com/podcast or search for The Art of Charm on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and start taking your life to the next level. I really enjoy this show, and I think you will as well. And of course, this was before scientists understood the effects of a nuclear winter. How many millions would that have added to the death totals from a nuclear war?
The fact is that the cities we were going to hit, and even now, they expect to hit those cities not per se as cities, as was then planned, but because there are military targets in those cities, transportation, command and control, air defense. The cities will burn. And as they burn in firestorms, which create enormous updrafts, the smoke and toxic soot from the cities by the hundreds of millions of tons, tens to hundreds of millions of tons, will be lofted into the stratosphere where it won't rain out and where it will surround the globe for, we now know, a decade or more, killing immediately, that is within weeks and months, all harvests. Ending the harvest, preventing new harvests, killing essentially all vegetation for food growing, and leading to the starvation of nearly all humans, perhaps 98 or 99% of humans, and 100% full extinction of virtually every other large animal, larger, say, than a squirrel or a raccoon. They'll be gone. They can't adapt the way we can with fires and clothes and housing and movement. So the Earth is considerably denuded of large-scale life and most humans. That's not by accident. We humans are living on a man-made Vesuvius, not knowing exactly when the eruption would occur, but building, rebuilding, assuring that there will be no capping of that volcano, no diversion of it.
So once you realized all this, did you have much success working to change the system from within?
I tried to modify the plan under Secretary of Defense McNamara in a number of major ways, taking China off the immediate target list, taking cities off the first strike target list, taking Moscow off on the belief that, as I told them, what if we'd hit Tokyo with the first, second, or third atom bomb? How long would we have been fighting Japanese soldiers in the islands and in China forever? It's hard to answer that question. Only the emperor could get them to surrender. Do you really want to deprive hundreds of Soviet weapons that we haven't destroyed and submarines of any centralized control that could end the war, limit the war, bring it to an end or not, you know, keep it from firing at our cities and so forth? Well, no, I've never really apparently persuaded any military man of the weight of that argument, because Moscow has always been the major target. And I can't make any sense out of that unless you imagined that that would paralyze the Soviet system. And that's what they do hope.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they know that a comparable targeting of Washington or SAC headquarters in Offutt Air Force Base, Omaha, would not paralyze our force. And it is turns out to be a fact, a secret held by the Soviets, that they couldn't be paralyzed either. They have what they call a dead hand system, which assures that if Moscow is hit, there will be retaliation, massive retaliation.
You talk about a number of near misses and miscalculations that could have led to a nuclear war over the past 70 years. How is it that we haven't either accidentally or intentionally set off the so-called doomsday machine in the decades since Hiroshima?
Well, I think it's kind of a secular miracle. How did it happen that we have survived those false warnings? Well, as you know from reading the book, in one case, a Soviet colonel chose to report that what he knew might be an attack was a false alert, was not an attack. He was right, fortunately, and the Soviet Union did not launch its forces, or we would not be here. So Stanislav Petrov, the colonel in charge, had a program naming him the man who saved the world, and had he not been on duty, you and I would not be having this conversation. Well, the same was true in the Cuban Missile Crisis. A commander named Arkhipov, Vasily Arkhipov, on a Soviet submarine, chose to countermand the intention of the ship's officer and his second-in-command to launch a nuclear torpedo during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Again, had Arkhipov not persuaded them not to do that, we would simply not be here. So a lot of luck has gone into this. And we could have that much luck another 70 years, but it's not likely, it's unlikely, unless the system changes.
Especially given recent events, and I want to talk about that. By your count, you say U.S. presidents have threatened the use of nuclear weapons 25 times, and you warn that a nation can only bluff so many times before the bluff is called. As President Trump and Kim Jong-un continue to ratchet up the nuclear rhetoric, do you fear that we may be approaching that moment?
Are President Trump and Kim Jong-un engaging not only in a war of nuclear chicken, a game of nuclear chicken here, which one is most bolder, but conducted in strangely childish ways? I mean, what can one say? I find this latest tweet just days ago, the day before history, of President Trump, it's not entirely uncharacteristic of him, but to say, my button is bigger and stronger, more powerful than yours. On one hand, you can say, that's ludicrous, that's ridiculous. Another case, I have to say, that strikes me as very unsettling. There's a strangeness to a president tweeting that out in these circumstances where war is a real possibility here. that is frightening. This is the first time that a president or any other leader has made threats of imminent attack to a nuclear weapons state, a state that has nuclear weapons to retaliate with, since the Cuban Missile Crisis, in which I participated 55 years ago. And so I can understand their being worried, especially about them, and they should be. The world should be massively outraged and protesting and resisting the very idea that these two leaders hold their populations entirely in risk. But the fact is that he's really directing our attention to dangers that have been there all along. What president can really be trusted with this responsibility? And the answer is that human hasn't been born.
Yeah, and I read that you think that Kim Jong-un probably has some sort of a dead hand strategy already in place if we should attempt to kill or remove him from power. What do you think that would look like?
I'm certain they have made arrangements, just as we have and the Russians have, that will not paralyze his retaliatory forces. And he's probably lying that he has ICBMs at this moment with warheads that can reach the United States. He has missiles that can get here, but can they carry a warhead that will get through the atmosphere and so forth at that distance? Probably not. On the other hand, he has boats and he has warheads. And there's no trick at all. It's low tech to put one of those warheads on a boat and send it to Long Beach Harbor or San Francisco Harbor, where I live, as retaliation and revenge. I would think that's, by the way, Rand projected that in a research study 11 years ago, 2006, when the North Koreans first tested a nuclear weapon. They said, well, what would it do? What would they do with a low-size fission-type weapon of the kind that destroyed Nagasaki at Long Beach Harbor? And the answer is 65,000 dead right away, another 250,000 dead through fallout before long, total disorganization of the country's transportation system. That surprised me a little, by the way. You know, as a layman, I would have thought, well, one port gone, we've got lots of ports. So apparently, the system is such, the network is such, take out one port like that and you've got immense logistic problems of supporting the rest of the nation. It is simply not, almost certainly not true, as Senator Lindsey Graham says, that if we go to war with North Korea, which will almost certainly escalate to nuclear war, that all the casualties will be over there. We'll have a wartime situation over here with immense casualties, even if they're confined to one, two, three cities, that will enormously overtax our entire hospital population, and I would say lead to martial law.
President Trump continues as recently as yesterday to suggest that there's some kind of deep state conspiracy working against him within the Justice Department, the military, the intelligence community, which sounds to me like lunatic paranoia. And yet you recall in this book encountering entrenched military bureaucrats who stymied you and tried to prevent presidents from knowing about the plan for general nuclear war. Does your experience lend some validity to this idea that there is a deep state operating separate from the president?
Well, the question is separate from the president. Yes, to a considerable extent it is. Now, a large apparatus is set up to protect the president from responsibility for covert operations specifically. For instance, they're authorized by a committee. It changes its name every time the name comes to print, which is every few years. It's not very common. I think it was earlier called the 5812 Committee, then the 303 Committee, then the 30 Committee, then, you know, one thing after another, the whole purpose of which is to take responsibility to cover the president. It's a cover story. Plausible denial. The president didn't know this. It's also true, though, that they can act against what they see as what they know is the president's desires or their intentions. Yes, these people operate in secret. That's their nature, whether they're appointees just brought in or whether they're, as the deep state suggests, whether they're long-term bureaucrats. They act conspiratorially by nature. They do that every day. Usually, it's at the desire of the president. And they're really more responsive on that than the public is ever allowed to believe. In other words, the president wants to be able to disclaim failures and crimes and lies and whatnot. And if they come out at all, he wants to be able to blame it on somebody else. But of course, that apparatus is also there to be used against a president. My concern right now, by the way, is that the generals that he has pawned to high power here will not go against all of their training and instincts and restrain him ultimately from terribly reckless acts. When you have to count on somebody who's supposedly the adult in the room who will restrain the president from acts, when you have to count on someone whose military nickname is Mad Dog, that's, you know, is not entirely reassuring. True. And that's where we are. Will those people really resign and refuse to carry out such orders? No one ever has. I don't know in history, certainly American history, when there's an example of that. They buckle in. They decide, well, even if it's a bad action, I will do it better than some other guy. And why throw up my career and let somebody else do it anyway?
Wow.
And if they did refuse, they would be replaced quickly.
Hmm.
So you could say, yes, there is a deep state, but the system's more complicated than that. We have a covert foreign policy generally led by the president. And the secrecy is above all to keep it from the public.
Well, before we go, as the most famous government whistleblower, I want to ask you, there's this cliche that no one in Washington can ever keep a secret. But in this book, you talk about the elaborate portfolio of security clearances you had and something called the two phone call system, which you say was very effective for decades. Is this idea that sooner or later everything comes out in the New York Times a myth?
Yes, it's simply a cover story. It's part of the indoctrination or the propaganda that helps to conceal all these secrets, to keep people from prying on the or putting it out on the assumption, well, you don't have to put it out. Someone will, if you're inside, someone else will eventually. They'll get it eventually. Not true. It can be generations, not just decades, but half a century. And some of those things have not come out yet, and that's well over half a century.
Mm-hmm.
The National Security Archive has been quite good in using the Freedom of Information Act to put a lot of this information out. But even so, they tend to be about 20 or 30 years behind the current situation. It can take them 10 or 20 years of court appeals to get that information out. So the truth is, secrets that should be known to the public can be effectively kept secret by hundreds and thousands of people for decades. And that's the truth. Well, the result of that is that we know about as much about what our government is doing in our name as a 5-year-old knows about what daddy is doing at the office or mommy.
Wow.
And even scholars and journalists who worked at this on documents and so forth are like 10-year-olds. The truth is, popular sovereignty is kind of a hoax. If there were people right now who could tell us what the real official estimates of the dangers of a war with North Korea are, the estimates that are being sent up to the White House, whether or not Donald Trump reads them. I just read today in a new book that he reads nothing.
Right.
But if they could get that information on Fox and Friends at the cost of their own freedom, let's say, putting it out, maybe getting it to the president, and meanwhile getting it to Congress, not that, you know, the Republican Congress is not exactly to be relied on, but the public, so that we could see the kind of reaction we had to his ban on airports at the beginning of the immigration ban, where people could say, not in our name, this is not right, and it's got to change. People can do that. Chelsea Manning, Ed Snowden show that it is possible. We need them now more than ever.
Well, Daniel Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine, is a sobering look at the risks of nuclear war. Just for the record, before we go, duck and cover, an effective plan?
That was part of the cover system, obviously. That's what okay. That was popular at a time when I was in the Marines, or later when I was writing more plans. But of course, it was absurd. It had nothing to do with making people safe, just from making them think that their government was somehow working to keep them safe when it wasn't. That has never been the highest priority of our government, yeah. Democrat or Republican.
Okay. Glad we cleared that up. Daniel Ellsberg, thanks for talking with me.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Daniel Ellsberg for joining me on the podcast. Order his book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, on Amazon, or download the audiobook at audible.com. Daniel Ellsberg is on Twitter at Daniel Ellsberg, and you can keep up with him and view lots of supplemental documents about the Pentagon Papers and America's nuclear war plan at ellsberg.net. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.